Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, brought to you from Santa Clara University. My name is Bob Saldick, and I will be your chair for this evening. At this time, we would like to thank Santa Clara's University's Center for Science, Technology, and Society for co-sponsoring this evening's program. It is my pleasure to introduce tonight's guest speaker, John Morgridge. John first joined Cisco Systems in 1988 as their president and CEO. During that period, John was instrumental in Cisco's financial success as the company grew from $5 million to over $1 billion. Cisco is now one of the fastest growing companies in the history of the computer industry. In 1995, John was appointed chairman of the board, and he now dedicates himself to broadening Cisco's education and government initiatives. His community endeavors have made him a recognizable face among numerous organizations and groups, including the Morgridge Family Foundation, the American Leadership Forum for Silicon Valley, the 21st Century Education Board, and the Stanford Business School Advisory Council. Because of his philanthropic and educational interests, John has won numerous awards, including the David Packard Leadership Award and the Center for Excellence's Philanthropist of the Year Award. John is an alumnus of the University of Wisconsin and is also a part-time professor at Stanford University's Graduate School of Business, where he was their 1996 Arbuckle Award honoree. With pleasure, I introduce John Morgridge.
Thank you, Bob. It's a delight for me to be with you here tonight. And speaking on one of my favorite topics, and that's the role of philanthropy in business, or effective business philanthropy. The world is in the throes of a major revolution. You know, all of us have been part of the Industrial Revolution that has been ongoing now for a couple of centuries. But we're now in a new revolution, and that is a revolution based on technology, a revolution that will recast the winners and the losers, the competitive and the non-competitive. And it is a revolution that is based not so much on location or particular natural resource and muscle, but a revolution that is based principally on educated minds. And it is not a revolution that will necessarily be won by the large and dominant, but by the swift, be they small or large. Indeed, a Chile can be competitive in this new revolution, as Costa Rica has clearly demonstrated. So it is a case of embracing this change and capitalizing on it. For it is a change that's going to touch not only our lives, but all of our institutions. And it is a change that will impact not only businesses, but governments, cities, nations, and indeed continents in terms of their relative competitive position in this new world economy. I've been part of the high-tech industry for 40 years. And I always wondered why I had such difficulty as an early salesperson. And what I learned was that the reason I had difficulty was that companies and institutions were spending only a small portion of their capital dollars on technology. Indeed, in the Industrial Revolution, they spent the vast majority of it on physical plants and machinery. However, in the last 5 years, indeed in the last decade, there's been a major transition. And institutions and corporations are increasingly spending their capital dollars on technology. Indeed, at the present time, over 50 cents out of every capital dollar goes into technology, as against a mere couple of percent, a mere 15 or 20 years ago. The other thing that has appeared is that in the early stages of the technology revolution, there was a very low correlation between investment and return. Indeed, when I started selling mainframe computers in the 60s, those dollars were actually became costs of the business rather than leverage of productivity in the business. That's changed with networking. The network effect is an effect that brings increased productivity as a result of that, of those investment dollars. And we've seen that in our own economy, particularly in the last several years, where we've actually grown at very high rates and have not had the typical side effect of high inflation. And that's because technology dollar investment brings increased productivity to the institution or business that's making that investment. It's interesting that the president of Chile is visiting here. I was in Chile early in the spring and actually had dialogue not only with the president but with his cabinet members and with members of the Senate in his country on the issue of how Chile or any small country can in effect be a participant and become competitive in this space. And I pointed out to him the phenomenon in Costa Rica, where some of you may not be aware, but Intel and Motorola both have put large plants there. And the reason they put plants there was because Costa Rica is a network country, and it's been networked for about a decade. And the key to any location addressing this new competitive challenge is to bring together three distinct groups. Those groups being your education institutions, because this revolution rides on the back of smart minds, state or local government, or federal government, and the business community. It's those three groups that need come together in order to enable and encourage a particular location to undertake and become part of this networked revolution. Indeed, I was in Chile to help launch a series of Cisco networking academies, which I'll talk about in a minute. Now, the global equalizers that, in effect, permit anyone to play in this new competitive arena are, first and foremost, the culture and the educational structure of that location country. And secondly, they have to have the backing of the government. You know, the president of Chile is coming looking for investment dollars. Very similar situation was the case in Israel a mere 10 years ago. And there, the Israeli government, lacking venture capitalists, put up the seed money to start companies in their country, and in fact actually established incubators. Today, they don't need to do that anymore because they have over 50 venture capitalists and plenty of venture money, both American and Israeli and from throughout the world, that are investing there. When it comes to philanthropy, Cisco views its role as being a vehicle to provide education and skills training to the communities that we're a part of. And since we're a global company, we're part of a global community. And we think that this is not only a responsibility, but that it's good business. That it's good business for us to take our total capabilities and make them available to the community. As a result, we've partnered with a lot of different organizations around the world, starting very close to home, certainly, but reaching out on a global basis, both through our Academy program, which I will point out in a few minutes is now in almost 90 countries around the world, and also with our NetAid program, which is using, in both cases, using internet technology as a lever in providing either aid or education on a global basis. We've also done some very unique specific programs where, in the case of Kosovo, we actually packaged up a network and linked the various refugee camps and then permitted the refugees to come in and register on a database. And via that vehicle, they were able to find friends and family members. And it was amazing how quickly they understood the impact and the method and how quickly they became part of and capitalized on doing it. We've also done some very rewarding things. We were part of networking the Special Olympics in North Carolina this past year. Actually, they had a network capability that was superior even to the Olympics in Australia. And it was done by volunteers from Cisco along with some of our Network Academy graduates, actually setting up the network at all the venues and then operating it for the 4 or 5 days that the Special Olympics went on. Now, one of the things that is very crucial in this new economy environment is the ability to partner. Companies that are successful in that space from a business standpoint understand how to do partnering because none of us bring the total solution. It's an open environment, and as a result, there's a necessity to partner with a lot of different corporations and suppliers. We take the same kind of mentality into our philanthropy, where we look not just to write checks, but also to become partners with a lot of different institutions, bringing all of our capabilities to the partnership, and thereby leveraging not just our dollars, but leveraging our products, our knowledge, our technical knowledge, and our human resources. And this is kind of a cultural part of the Cisco culture, and it's reflected in our community outreach. Perhaps the program that I'm most closely associated with and most proud of is the Cisco Networking Academy program. This is a program to train principally juniors and seniors in high school the fundamentals of networking and how to design and install and maintain networks. And we came to this as a result of moving in next door to Castaño School in East Palo Alto. We had a facility right next door, and it wasn't long before our employees were climbing the fence, and it wasn't too long thereafter that the president followed along and went over and introduced himself to the principal, Marty Hargrove. And as you might expect, we showered them with a lot of our technology. And we found out very quickly that, yes, they could they needed some of the technology, but what they really needed was an understanding of how to apply it. And so it wasn't long before we were giving seminars, and of course we learned quickly that that didn't scale very well. And so the next step was, why not use technology to carry out the training? So we developed a course that was deliverable via PC off a server using the internet to provide the curriculum and do the testing. And we piloted it up at Thurgood Marshall High School in San Francisco in the spring of 1997. It was successful, and that fall we launched it on a national basis, and we had some 64 institutions around the United States and seven states teaching that curriculum. That was 3 years ago. And the curriculum is 280 hours, delivered over four semesters, taught as an elective, the same way you would take Spanish or French, to seniors, juniors and seniors in high school. It's been very successful in helping these students learn the fundamentals of networking. So successful, as a matter of fact, that we've now launched just this fall an additional 280 hours to take the student to a higher level. At the end of the course, the student can take a third-party exam and be certified as and Cisco certified. And this certification is a worldwide recognized standard certification that has the same quality meaning, whether it's in the UK, Japan, or the United States. The student is tested frequently online every five sessions. And this is a course that's not taught to develop a capability on Cisco equipment, but it's taught to industry standards that the student can use irrespective of the particular equipment that they're using. That was 3 years ago. Today we have over 5,300 institutions in some now almost 90 countries around the world. We've trained 12,000 instructors. We've given 2.5 million exams, and it's been translated into 9 different languages. A very strong demonstration of the power of the internet. But it's also the power of partnering, because realize that we didn't provide the classroom, we did not provide the instructor, we did not provide the students. Someone else did that. We provided the curriculum and some technology and some training. That's the power of partnering. That's how you can accomplish very unusual tasks in relatively short periods of time. And as I said, we're all over the world, not just in first world countries, but across the whole spectrum. And we've recently committed to actually provide academies in the 25 poorest nations in the world, partnering in this case with the Peace Corps and also with UNDP, the United Nations Development Group. Now, the other thing that we've come to realize through this outreach program is sometimes we don't really capitalize on all the assets that are available. You know, initially we put them in high schools, but now we have them in detention centers. We have one over in Oakland. They had a unique problem. Some of the graduated from incarceration before they graduated from the course. And strangely enough, they seemed to reappear on another offense. And as a result of that, the director of the program said you could actually stay and finish the program without necessarily being incarcerated. But we've also put it on Indian reservations. We've put it at OICW. We had our stockholders meeting today, and I had the pleasure of introducing two students from OICW who will be graduating next week, who have taken the course. As we say, the student can be in a body from about 15 to 70. The only requirement is that they have a young mind. If they have a young mind, they can pass this course. One of the other unique applications is we're actually putting it in churches in the UK. Vast majority of the economically disadvantaged in the UK are the minorities belong to strong church organizations. So we're going to use the churches as the foundation for our academies, drawing both students and instructors out of their congregations. I think we have to think, you know, it's important to think in kind of an out-of-the-box fashion. Now, one of the other things that have come out of this program is a set of software to deliver curriculum and also to assess the student on how well they're doing. And we've made that software available and are running a series of tests this fall using totally different curriculum, teaching Spanish literature as an example, or Braille, or oceanography. And what it says is that there is this capability to use this software in a unique way. As a result of that, we've actually established a learning institute, Cisco Learning Institute, which is a public foundation that is the owner of that software and will make it available relatively low cost to nonprofit organizations that want to put up curriculum on it. Now, on a broader basis, we also fund an outreach through our communities. We actually have groups of employees that pass on donations and donation requests at our four major sites in here in Silicon Valley, in Raleigh, North Carolina, New York City, and Boston, Massachusetts. And the vast majority of that money goes into education and also into various social programs with a particular emphasis on food. We view this and we fund it by taking some of our venture investments and taking those investments and using those as the foundation for the Cisco Foundation. And we currently have about $130 million worth of underlying investments that fund our outreach. And we use that because it ensures that even in more difficult times for the company, which we haven't had and hopefully won't, we'll have a funding source off of that that endowment that permits us to continue those programs. I mentioned NetAid, and here again, I think the important thing is that the NetAid idea was to bring donors and people that had the requirement together, and we used the internet as the vehicle to accomplish that task. And it's currently operational. You can go to netaid.org and get a feel for exactly what that program is doing. Closer to home, and actually this is a program we started a long time ago, is Second Harvest Food Bank. We've always felt it's a great investment. You know, it returns about $12 for every dollar you invest. And so we've been major supporters of it. But not only here in Silicon Valley, but also in Raleigh, North Carolina, in New York City, and in Boston. And actually, in North Carolina, you know, it was very fortunate. They had terrible flooding there this year. And Cisco stepped up through our outreach program. And this is a program where management actually matches what the employees give along with the Cisco Foundation. So you actually get $2 for every $1 you donate. And it kind of illustrates how the corporation can influence employee philanthropy. Some years ago, we launched a program called Take a Router to School. And it was interesting because most principals didn't know what a router was. Or they'd say, yes, we could use one in our shop class. But what it really was the ability of our employees to buy our equipment and donate it to the school of their choice at a very deep discount. So, again, we influenced the employee giving through the corporate giving program. And more recently, we've used it to try and get a lot of the nonprofits in the shape up to speed with their networks, because they're often the last ones to do it. Now, one of the things that's important in philanthropy is to leverage all your unique gifts, not just your dollars, but your human capital, your products, your services, and last but not least, the unique ability to manage a project. You know, most corporate giving is a check, but corporations have project management capabilities, and we've clearly demonstrated with the success of the Academy program that is a very unique asset that a corporation can bring in conjunction with education and government and really leverage the result. I've been doing this now for the better part of 10 years, and I just wanted to close with a few of the things that I've learned from that. Number one, you should capitalize on all the corporate assets. Number two, you should leverage third-party assets. Assets of other people, both your partners and non-partners, and we certainly have done that with the academies. Don't underestimate the power of the internet. It has huge leverage, and you can capitalize on it. Balance money with human capital. Make sure there's passion at the top. Lead by example, and don't expect it to happen overnight. I close by saying good giving is good business. Thank you.
Thank you, John, for sharing your thoughts with us. It's really wonderful and refreshing to see how a marvelously successful businessman and a wonderfully successful company, what happens when they are dedicated to improving the surrounding community. Now I would like to introduce Peter Delavette, who will conduct our question and answer period. Peter is the weekly wiretap columnist for the San Jose Mercury News. Peter?
Thanks, Bob. Mr. Morgridge, we have a number of questions from the audience this evening, so let's get right to those. We could start by asking you in a broader sort of macro sense, what is the role that philanthropy plays in a company culture, and how does the company benefit from embracing philanthropy?
The impact of well-focused philanthropy in a business impacts all of your constituencies. And it impacts them in a way that perhaps advertising or other kinds of marketing don't. It starts by impacting your employees, and it impacts them in a multiplicity of facets, but it also impacts your partners. It impacts your relationships with government. I mean, it's been a superb. The Academy program has had a superb effect relative to how we're viewed by the people, a man on the street, governments, schools. It just totally changes that. So I think that it's not so much a question of whether you should. It's a question of thinking it through and capitalizing on your unique talents in a unique way that impacts real problems. And if you can do that, it's just got a marvelous impact.
We were talking before the program about sometimes shareholders might be tempted to ask questions about the value that a company derives from philanthropy. Would your answer that you just gave encompass some of those answers to a question like that?
Well, I think in the case of shareholders, you can approach them on two levels. You certainly can approach them on the level of just this is a good being a good corporate citizen, without necessarily specifically tying it to the business. In our case, we can also tie it very specifically to the business. I would cite as an example the fact that we had no particular franchise in either K-12 education or state government. Indeed, I could make the argument that some of our competitors had much stronger positions going into that marketplace. And yet, through the Academy program, we have become the vendor of choice in that space, in both state government and also in K-12 education. And so, as a shareholder, there is a very direct return. And if you target it correctly, create it correctly, you can have that kind of impact and justification to the shareholder.
A great many questions that we have concern the digital divide. One person wants to know, what role do you see for government and private business in bringing the internet to everyone?
Well, I'm a strong believer that, at least in this country, we've come to the conclusion that, number one, we aren't going to have government do it all. We kind of experimented with that, and I think as a people, we have kind of said that's not the solution. My own belief is that the solution lies in this idea of partnering, which, incidentally, most governments have struggled to do. They struggle to be a partner as against running it. And the key is to get the various parties to the table to bring, you know, their particular expertise and resources to it. And I think if that's done, then you can have a real impact, and government can play a role, not necessarily the dominant role, but I think they have a role. Certainly, education has a role. And then business has a role. And really the key is to bring the three parties to the table in terms of accomplishing it.
You mentioned partnering. We've gotten a couple of questions about that. One person would like to know if Cisco partners with your customers or suppliers in your philanthropic programs, and more broadly, did Cisco's partnership approach to philanthropy develop out of its business practices?
Well, I'll answer the second part of the question first. Certainly, we've had a long history of developing a partnering attitude, and that's not easy to do. You know, the industrial model historically was vertical integration, where you did everything. And from a business standpoint, we've all long had a philosophy in Cisco: only do those things where you bring unique value. If you don't bring unique value, then get a partner. Get someone else to manufacture it. Get someone else to do your education. Don't run your dining hall. Don't do your landscaping. We're not experts at that. Apply your resource where you really have it. So that's culturally ingrained in the company. And as a result, we've brought that to our philanthropic outreach, that same attitude of attempting to get partners, be they nonprofits, be they other businesses. You know, I was just in a kickoff at our Academy program in Rhode Island, and we were at a school. The governor was there because he had helped with funding. And there were a number of businesses there that had adopted academies and were buying equipment, underwriting the training, providing internships at their locations, supporting from a technological standpoint that academy, that teaching institution. That's an excellent model, and that's a model that we strive to establish with our partners, and those partners can be suppliers, they can be vendors to us, they can be our customers. You know, we solicit all of them to be part of it.
One person would like to know if non-governmental organizations, NGOs, have played any kind of role in implementing the network academies.
Well, absolutely. I mean, OICW is an NGO up in East Palo Alto. It's a community-based nonprofit job training center, and it's been there for a long time and has been supported by a lot of folks. And Sun and Cisco set up a technical training academy there, and they're teaching our academy curriculum. But there are a lot more examples of those types of things. We also had it. We also have it in a community center over in Oakland. We have it, as I mentioned, going into churches in the UK. So we're doing a lot of that sort of thing. I would say the vast majority on the academy program has been done with education institutions, both public and private.
I think this is an interesting question. One person asks, in partnering, how do you ensure quality control? If you're not running the program, how do you ensure that it's implemented the way that you think it ought to be?
You know, one of the things that's it's wonderful to me to see how the culture and methodologies of the company that we use in business swing right over and are applied in other programs that we do. One of the things that we do at Cisco is, number one, we do a lot of measurement. We have a lot of partners. For instance, we probably have 35 factories, only 3 or 4 of which are ours. All the rest belong to someone else. But we're online to every one of those factories. And we get feedback from every one of those factories on their quality. Actually, in some cases, we install our own quality measurements so that we're there. So when we came to the academy, guess what? We did the same thing. Not only did the students take the tests, guess who else does? All the instructors take the test, and they're held to a higher standard. And we actually have a whole process. If a academy is failing in terms of the students, then we go in and we actually do an audit. Actually, it's not Cisco usually. It's usually one of our teaching partners, typically a community college or university. They go in and do an audit. They do an audit of the instructor, his or her training. Why are the students not succeeding? What does the facility look like? Do they have the right equipment? And then we have a change plan to change it. And that whole quality program was automatic. I mean, when we set the program up, the people said, oh, we got to have a measurement system and a quality system, and we have to have a remedial methodology. We have to have a closed loop because that's the way we do it in our business activities. So we just took that same model and applied it. And that's how we maintain the quality. In addition to that, to be Cisco certified, you have to take an exam at the end of the course. And first you have to pass the course at 80% level. Then you are entitled to take a third-party exam, and if you pass the third-party exam, then you're Cisco certified as a network associate. Or now under the new course, you'll be able to be certified at a higher level as a Cisco certified network professional. Thank you. You're taking the course?
That's right. It is professional.
Mr. Morgish, do you feel Cisco is leading the revolution toward combating the digital divide?
There are so many people who are participating that I would have a hard time to say who's leading. Certainly, we're active. And, you know, one of the things that I like about this company is that we may not be the best planners in the world. We may not have the greatest strategic vision, but boy, we can execute. And sometimes execution is just as important as having the right vision. I can tell you this, if you have the right vision and can't execute, it ain't worth nothing. So certainly we're a party to it, and we are engaging all across the spectrum. You know, we're engaging all across the spectrum, not only in this country, at a city level, at a state level, at a federal level, but we're engaging around the world. And we're engaging around the world at those same levels, both at a city level, at a community level, and also at a national level. So I don't know that who's leading it, but we're right up there with them.
We have a contrarian in the audience who asks, we always assume that bringing the internet to people is a good thing. Can you think of circumstances anywhere in the world where internet access would prove more destructive to indigenous lifestyles than it would add benefit?
I think that's a very tough question. I start with the premise that people around the world are going to be exposed. And the question is, how can you make that exposure? They're going to be impacted by change. There is no question about that they're going to be impacted by change. And I've got to believe that to survive in the world as it evolves, training, learning, and education are an important thing. And the best vehicle that we're going to have, I mean, you take a country, you take a continent like Africa, where currently about half of the teachers are dying of AIDS. Those people and that whole generations are going to be deprived of education. And I don't think it's going to be to their benefit. And if we can use the internet and technology to help address that, I can't conceive that that's a bad thing. And so I'm sure there are exceptions, but I would say as a general rule that it can have a positive impact. And, you know, it's going to be, I think you're going to be amazed how much education and training changes in this decade with the new tools that are available in this space. And I think we should leverage it positively. And so I guess that's the best answer I can give to that very kind of thoughtful question.
One person tonight wonders if women will have equal access to the growth of the internet, especially in developing countries.
We actually have a program. It may have been listed on one. I guess it's not on any of the material I showed you. But we actually have a program in Africa specifically focused on women. And it is a challenge. I go around. I've been in hundreds of academy classrooms. And the ratio is typically 2 or 3 out of 10 are females. Although, where was I? I was somewhere recently where there were just 2 or 3 males, and all the rest of the class was female. So all of that is possible. I think the key is, and one of the reasons that the academies may be able to change that, is we're exposing them early in their learning careers. Actually, I'd like to see the program taught at ninth grade, because I think I think that their minds can absorb it there, and then we stand a better chance of getting girls to embrace and understand it, because they'll be exposed to that. If you wait until they graduate high school, it's unlikely that they'll get into technology in college. You've got to expose them earlier. And I think that certainly we're emphasizing it in the program. I actually had was up in Montana, and the teacher was a home economics teacher. And she was actually learning technology for the first time. I mean, she'd been teaching home economics for a long time, and she was becoming a network. She came up to me and said, "I'm becoming a network expert, because I'm actually taking this." They actually take the course along with their students. So,
got a number of questions about the nuts and bolts of how the academies work. The first question is, how do students get selected to participate in the academy program? The person also would like to know what percentage of the 130,000 plus who have gone through the program have actually been certified.
I'll answer the last half first, and that is that there are 133,000, perhaps more than that now. I don't know what the date of that number was, that are enrolled in one of the four semesters. So it's a four-semester program, and it probably turns out that there are about 15,000 in the fourth semester, and a huge number in the first semester, because a lot of those academies launched this fall, and so we've actually had about 4,000 or 5,000 who have graduated through the four semesters. And I can't tell you how many are certified. And the reason for that is anyone can take the certification. You don't have to go through the academy program to take the certification. Now, we're attempting to get that statistic by actually offering a huge discount on the test. The test, I can't remember, is a couple $100s or something. And we give out a certificate that lets you take it for a small number, just so that we can identify how many are taking and passing it. But we do know that those that have taken it out of the academies, the vast majority of them are passing it. So it now, what was the other part of
it?
How do they get selected? Almost always they quasi self-select. But as a practical matter, the way they're selected is that teachers select them. Because I always ask that question. How did you get involved in this? Why are you taking this course? You know, because it's an elective for these kids. And invariably they say, well, Mr. So-and-so or Mrs. So-and-so said, you should take this program. I think you'd find it interesting. So the vast majority of my either self-select. I was up in Whitefield, New Hampshire at the high school up there, and one of the kids came up to me and gave me his business card. It said computer and network consultant. Now, this is a junior in high school. He self-selected. I asked him, I said, do you have a PC at home? He said, yes, 7 of them. You know, and I built 2 of them. You know, I mean, so a lot of them self-select, and particularly early on in the program. But now it's a case that actually parents are encouraging kids to take the program because there is such a job demand. I mentioned we had the OICW, a couple of OICW graduates down. I asked them how their class was doing. They said, well, the class started with 27, but 3 got hired even before they finished the course, so they're no longer taking it.
I saw a few wrinkled brows when you mentioned the cost of the exam. Is there a cost? You were talking about not talking about the students, school students who want to take the exam, or is there a cost to them as well to take the test?
No, we provide a chit so they can take the exam. If you wanted to take the exam, just walking off the street, I think it's $150 or something to take the exam, something like that.
Just a couple of other questions about the academies. What if the curriculum is not offered at a particular school that someone wants to that someone's attending? And related to that, is there any concern about whether there might be a sort of a brain drain from one school to the other if one school does offer the curriculum and another one doesn't?
Well, in the case of Boston, they actually have the course is sometimes taught in 0 hour. You know what that is? That's the period before the period. And it's often taught in 7th or 8th hour. And in Boston, they actually bus them. And in North Dakota, they actually they bus them because they don't have academies in every school. Some of the schools are very small. That said, a lot of the academies are in community colleges. And, of course, anyone can go to – you can be in a high school and take a community college course. They are not expensive. I just saw a flyer. Someone at our shareholders meeting came up and said, is this a legitimate Cisco Academy? It was a community college down in L.A., and it was, I think, $44 a semester to take the course, $280 for whatever for the four semesters. So it's available in a lot of different places. That said, Many of the high schools actually also self-selected, and but it's available to any high school that's got a lab that's can get someone to give them $10,000 to buy the lab equipment, and has an instructor that they can get trained. So it can really be in almost any high school that really desires it.
I have another contrarian out there who asks whether the goal of education should be to create a well-rounded individual or to prepare someone to fill a particular job slot. It seems to me, this person writes, that businesses that have become involved in education are primarily interested in creating an employee.
Well, I think that that also is a very good question. That said, people coming out of high school are going to go into a world and are going to look for a job. And we have enriched this program. It has all the job skill requirements that have been laid out. It can be enriched. There are projects. There's a requirement to work as teams. It requires the ability to write a proposal, to do math, to understand concepts. So certainly if they're going to be successful in the network academy program, they have to have a broader education, or they have to read at an eighth grade level. They have to do mathematics. This is for the first program. If you want to take the follow-on program, it's very challenging. And so I think that this is not intended to be an education. This is intended to be part of an education. And one of the beauties of it is that one of the reasons it's been successful is that students in high school and in college want some part of their education to have a practical touch, where they can actually have a sense that what they're learning is important in the world they're going to be part of, that they're going to work in. I'm not saying that the other isn't important. I'm only saying that this actually is an adjunct to get them to understand and realize the importance of education. We've had a lot of anecdotal stories of kids who were dropping out of high school, who became involved in this program, and as a result of it, understood why English was important suddenly, why math was important, why you had to be able to read, and why you had to be able to write as part of it. So, and then, of course, there's the whole aspect of working as a team. We actually wired the Democratic Convention. We wired the Republican Convention. We've wired a lot of shows using kids out of the academy. And some of them actually out in North Carolina, they actually run a business service that maintains the school networks. And the amazing thing is that the networks used to be down for 2-3 days at a time. Now they're down less. The average outage is less than an hour because the kids have T-shirts and beepers. And when they get a call from their school, guess what? They're there and they get it fixed.
A person in the audience asks, with regard to individual philanthropy, we've heard a lot about Microsoft millionaires giving back to Seattle and less about Cisco millionaires giving back here, I would assume. Does that reflect Cisco's more recent success, or perhaps a lower key emphasis on personal philanthropy for Cisco executives?
Actually, there's been a lot of emphasis on personal philanthropy at Cisco because we feel that that's one of the things that we need leave. You know, in Silicon Valley, a vast majority of the wealth created is individual wealth. It's not corporate wealth in the conventional sense, which is a little different perhaps than it was historically. So individual giving is very important. And we have a whole series of programs to stimulate, not the least of which is Take a Router to School, a matching grant program. We actually have advisor from Silicon Valley Community Foundation at the Cisco site. We're running seminars on setting up your own foundation. I think you'll find that there is a lot of giving at Cisco and by Cisco employees. You know, the Second Harvest food program was interesting. I started out very early matching our employees' giving, and it wasn't long before the vice presidents were matching employee givings. And so it takes a little time, but you can develop that kind of a culture, and we have that culture at Cisco.
Unfortunately, we've reached that point in our program where we have time for just one last question. And that question is this. What do you feel is the most important contribution that Cisco has made to the community?
Well, I would have to say that the most important contribution is jobs. You know, what I've really come to realize, and I think most of our politicians have come to realize, is there's no better tonic than a strong economy. It provides so much leverage. It permits you to do so many things, and those are not available without a strong economy and without a strong set of jobs. And Cisco has brought good jobs to this community, the community that it's a part of. And so I would say that they've been continuous jobs. You know, this hasn't been just a one-year phenomenon or a two-year phenomenon. Of course, we talk about internet years as being equal to seven. And in some sense, they are. So I guess you can say we're 70 years old or thereabouts. But I would rate that number one, the continuity. And these are good jobs, not only in terms of compensation, but in terms of the work environment that these people are involved in. You talk to our employees, and they like working for Cisco. So it's not only a well-paying job, but it's a job that I enjoy doing. My wife is always concerned that I'll spend too much time there because I become infected with it. Thank you very much.
Again, we'd like to thank John Morgridge, Chairman of the Board of Cisco Systems, Peter Delavette, columnist for the San Jose Mercury News, Santa Clara University's Center for Science, Technology, and Society for co-sponsoring this evening's event, and to all of you for joining us this evening. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, part of the nation's largest and oldest public affairs forum, is adjourned.